before Jeremy said that, sent a picture of my ID along with a credit card bacon.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 44 of Bad Voltage. I would like to point out that I've been gone for a little while due to a series of unfortunate mishaps. My name is Brian, and it is damn good to be back. Hey, fellas, specifically Jono, what the hell are we talking about today?
So, in the last episode, we did a segment called Bad Voltage Fixes the Fucking World, where we plan to fix the world, and we covered Mozilla. And today we want to talk about any possible reaction to that segment.
We've done a thing where we decided to advertise the show on various different social media things. And we all went away and did it. And now we come back and relate how we got on.
Also in this episode, Stuart will review Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson.
And then we will take on part two of Bad Voltage Saves the Fucking World. Fixes the Fucking World. With this time, we're going to be tackling the granddaddy that pooped out things like GitHub and Launchpad. We're going to be tackling SourceForge.
And now, Bad Voltage.
On the last episode of Bad Voltage, we kicked off a segment, possibly a series, which is going to become a series. In fact, it is a series. What am I talking about? Called Bad Voltage Fixes the Fucking World. Maybe Bad Voltage
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I have to stop here for a second. Jono, I've given you a lot of hell for your terrible names for segments over the last 17 years we've done this show. That is the first time you've ever named anything that I thought was an awesome name, by the way. That is an awesome name.
You see, you guys give me shit about the names all the time, but you always like them.
No, we never liked them.
Just
accept
this
the
one.
Love. What about the bad voltage perversification reverse? What
it's that horrible, man. So, all right, continue.
Moving right along.
On the last episode, so the idea of this is that we're going to basically pick an organization or a project or something that we feel has maybe lost its way a little bit and say, what would we do to fix it? And we picked Mozilla on the last one. And the idea of this segment series type thing is that we'll try and get somebody on the following show to have listened to the shit show that was the previous segment and then provide commentary and response. So, Brian, you reached out to Mozilla.
So it opens up a dialogue. It's nice.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right.
So, Brian, you reached out to Mozilla. What was the deal?
Sure as heck did. So I sent an email over to the Mozilla press department and kind of let them know what was up, sent them a link to the show, said, hey, you know, we really want to get Mozilla's viewpoints on this. We want to hear from you guys. What do you guys think? What are your loves? What are your dreams? Do you like puppies? What's going on? And I said, you know what, if you don't have anyone you can spare to go on the show when we record, would you like to forward along a written statement or something along those lines? And I'm going to read to you guys the exact response I got from the PR department over at Mozilla. Hi, Brian. Thank you for your email. Respectfully, we will decline this opportunity. Best regards. And then the person's name. That was the whole thing.
So
I followed up again with them. I'm like, just to be clear, what exactly are you declining? Are you declining to make comments entirely? Are you declining to come on the show? Are you declining to make a statement? And I never got a response. So that's the entirety of that conversation.
They just respond with everything.
Yeah, they decline everything.
Right. So,
and your question then becomes, is this not a bit worrying?
Right? It is a bit concerning. I mean, I'm not for a second suggesting that we're a big deal. We're not a big deal. But I went and listened to the last episode because, you know, with a segment titled Bad Voltage Fixes the Fucking World, arguably someone could look at that segment title and think this is not good. Because, you know, it's pretty common for a lot of PR people to want to avoid, you know, bad press and all the rest of it.
Sure.
But I went and listened to our previous episode and listened to that segment, and I actually thought it was really, really balanced. I thought we handled it in a pretty professional and respectful way. So I was a bit disappointed that they wouldn't at least throw us a sentence.
More than a bit disappointed. I mean, fine, we have in the past looked at particular projects and done nothing but dump shit on them, right? The Mars One people, if they said, we're not coming on your show, man, all you did was kick us in the nuts for 30 minutes, then fine, I can understand that.
Also, but, by the way, before you go on, the aerobics dude, right?
The aerobics dude, who came on the show,
right? That guy came on, and we gave that a shelling.
Exactly. Jono gave the elementary guys one hell of a going over. Boom. The leader of the project came on to talk about it. And no questions were off the record. They're like, let's just have this conversation. And that is what an open, freedom-loving organization does, is they talk.
Well, it's what they used to do. Mozilla used to very, very much be a place where employees were encouraged to speak their minds, even if they disagreed with management or senior management or the CEO. It really didn't matter. And that's, I think, one thing that disappointed me the most about this is that I held Mozilla to a higher standard than I hold a lot of companies.
Yeah.
And I guess my realization here is that the Mozilla of old might just not exist anymore. And there's certainly a core within the organization that is very much pro open web and very much still wants to change the world. But I think in many ways, to me now, Mozilla is 1,000+ person organization with the PR department, with the former employees from CNN and the BBC that are going to respond to you in a way that is not congruent with the way I was typically used to having a conversation with Mozilla. And to me, that's a net loss for the web, a net loss for open source, and mentally a net loss for me, which is, I think, why it's just...
It's disappointing. Yeah, I mean,
phenomenally disappointing.
Mozilla we're talking about, right? It's not just, some company who happens to do open source stuff. They're flag bearers for the whole concept.
Yes.
Of openness and sharing and community and working with people. And part of the thing here is, I think... we've seen this quite a lot with open source companies who start to become commercial and have a product and so on. Canonical have gone through the same thing, to be honest, where you go, well, okay, we're now a professional company and we have secrets and things like that, so we must lock everything down. But actual proprietary companies have some sense of media training. They're aware that just building a wall around the building and not talking to anybody is a really bad idea.
It's true.
You talk to Microsoft and they mail you back, right, Brian? Because they've had 30 years to learn
that this is kind of an
actually
interesting
a good
thing.
Relationship with the media is a good idea.
So Jono made an interesting point. We are nothing special. We are Bad Voltage. We are four guys having a good time hanging out. We're not that special. I do my tech journalist thing, but all of that's very Linux and open source centric. However, when I email Microsoft or Apple or hell, Oracle, any companies that we in the open source world would think, oh, they're not going to get back to us. Even when I'm hostile towards them and I send them questions that are just like raking them over the coals, that are the well-worded equivalent of why you guys suck so bad. They have always, in every instance, responded to me with at least a little statement. Sometimes they'll do an interview with me, like they'll sit down on the phone for 10 or 15 minutes. Sometimes they'll send me back a little quote that's just like, hey, we think you suck too. Bye-bye. But at least it's something. It's an actual response. Mozilla is the only, and I mean only, organization that I have repeatedly tried to get a hold of about issues that I consider to be important where they simply decline to get involved in any sort of conversation whatsoever. That's crazy to me.
It's like talking to Disney.
I mean, it reminds me of what people have said about Disney, that Disney is, is that any outgoing communication has to be, goes through this filtration system where it basically sucks out the any level of personality, which I think is one of the things that we cherish about open source companies.
Yep.
Is that, I mean, look at Red Hat, right? Yeah. Red Hat, $1 billion. They're about to approach like a $2 billion valuation for Red Hat. And they are, I think, generally very, very good at how they engage and interact with people publicly.
They really
are.
They're
a huge company.
And you know what's crazy? I work for SUSE, one of their big competitors. When I email them, they respond to me as a journalist, and they invite me to their events. They're open, not just with people that they feel are going to be positive towards them, but people that they feel might even be critical towards them. And that's something that they deserve mad high fives for. And a lot of open source companies are that way. When I write a story telling the world how much I think Canonical is sucking right now, you know what happens? Mark Shuttleworth hops on the internet and starts rambling, and half the time puts his foot in his mouth. But it's awesome because there's because it's dialogue. It's open dialogue. And again, Mark Shuttleworth and Canonical deserve a high five for that because they're being open. They're being honest. They're being transparent. And Mozilla is the only of those free and open organizations that I have had interactions with that just closes themselves off and sticks themselves in this little safe at the bottom of the sea, and they don't want anyone to know what they're doing, and they don't want to talk about anything that they're doing. It's just the weirdest thing.
So what
kind of
strikes me there, and I hadn't thought about it really until now, is that using your example as Red Hat, who I think is a great example of a company that does it right, and if you email anyone from an engineer to PR to pretty much anyone in that organization, they are very good at getting back to you in a way that you can tell is not really PR filtered. It's just their response.
Yeah.
And I think maybe part of that is that I think people at Red Hat are confident in the story that is Red Hat. They believe. And I think it might be that Mozilla has lost its way a little bit internally and doesn't really know who they are or what they are. Or, you know, you're looking at a foundation that's really predicated on a browser for now. I know they're doing Rust and they're doing Firefox OS and they're trying to find their way in other ways. But right now they're really predicated on a browser whose main income stream was the company whose browser is now eating their lunch, and maybe they don't have confidence in their story right now, and because of that, they're just locking it down. I don't know the answer.
That's actually a really good point. I mean, in the previous segment, we discussed a bunch of things wrong with Mozilla, and we suggested 15 different directions they could go in, and we all disagreed on which way they should go. And it wouldn't surprise me if they're having exactly that conversation internally. Well, what the hell do we do tomorrow? You know, when the plan was be Internet Explorer, then it was relatively easy to get everyone to line up behind that goal. But now you've got some people going, we need to build phones, and some people going, we need to build the open web and build things like WebMaker. And some people say, well, what we want to do is Rust. And some people say, no, we need to do the browser, or the browser on Android, or the browser on our own platform. And I wonder if they have no idea internally, and they're afraid that if that's exposed, that they have no idea, then that will in itself kill the company. Yeah. It's a very corporate way to think, that indicating to people that you're not sure what to do is in itself bad because it indicates that there is a problem. And if you keep it secret, no one will ever notice. It's bollocks. But it is bollocks. Lot of people in suits think it.
You know what's weird about it is that I've often thought that when you see things like this, it's often a failure of leadership, where it's leadership basically mandating this and it filters down the ranks. What's unusual? So about 2-3 weeks back, I wanted to write an article about the open source organizations. I did an interview with Jim Whitehurst, who's the CEO of Red Hat. Never met him before. Eric had met him once before, and she said, "Oh, he seems like a pretty cool guy." And I spent half an hour on the phone with him, and that guy, I could not be more impressed with him. Like, he clearly gets it.
Yeah,
and the culture and the people of open source, he just really fundamentally owns it. Like, he just released a book recently called The Open Organization. It doesn't surprise me that Red Hat has you know, shit rolls downhill, right? That his perspectives are epitomized in Red Hat. What's weird to me is that I know two executives at Mozilla, Mitchell Baker, who is brilliant, who runs Mozilla, and then this other guy called Mark Sermon, who's one of their executive directors, who really gets it as well. So I wonder whether these challenges that are going on inside of Mozilla and maybe bubbling up in the center, whether there's a lack of morale, or it's difficult to make statements without having
a couple of things there. The first one is their CTO has just left. Andreas Gahl has just...
Oh, really?
Well, I don't know whether he's just announced that he's quitting or he has quit and that was the announcement.
But and he's the second CTO they lost in pretty rapid succession.
Yeah,
obviously.
Really rapid.
And web guy, right? So I know a whole bunch of people at Mozilla. And importantly, I know a whole bunch of people who were at Mozilla and now aren't. And there seems to be more people leaving than you would expect. And the impression I get from this is these are not people who who thought, wow, there is a much better job for me over the horizon. I will reluctantly go to it.
Right.
These are people who were looking to leave Mozilla and then find somewhere else. And I wonder, I mean, it's hard to tell from out here what the culture's like inside. But I don't think we're the only people saying this is worrying that they have this huge fundamental shift in internal culture.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting when you look at the Glassdoor. Like, Glassdoor is a website that basically has anonymous reviews of where people work.
Oh, really?
And it's you got to bear in mind, of course, that, you know, it's a hive of people just carping. Like, people who got fired for legitimate reasons will often go to Glassdoor and give a company a 1-star rating.
Presumably, no one goes there and writes, "I love this place; it's brilliant. The only reason I left is because I discovered buried treasure in the backyard."
I mean, there are definitely people who say, you know, they love working there, and that it. But what it does is it shows you trends, and the trend at Mozilla has gone down fairly significantly. So it sounds like it's, you know, a lot of companies go through this when they get to being a large company, that they don't deal with scale very well.
I think Jeremy and Brian's points are absolutely right, that this is shocking behavior, more shocking than we'd expect from, you know, proprietary companies who we love to hate. And it's such a big change from the way Mozilla used to be. If Microsoft's not doing, you go, "Oh, well, typical proprietary company." But this is Mozilla.
But they don't. Microsoft doesn't do that. And that's...
They absolutely don't.
Bonkers to me. And
another thing that's worrying, too, is it doesn't seem like senior-level management at Mozilla thinks this is an issue.
Right.
All, from what I can tell.
Right.
Which...
That's a good point.
I don't know if they're too close to it or what it is, but it seems like...
Yeah, I don't know.
As obvious as it seems to us from the outside, I don't think they necessarily see it from the inside at the upper levels.
They need a community manager.
Let's hey, Jono. Yeah, Jono, you have any spare time? They could use one of you guys.
Let's do this. Let's do this.
Send them a copy of the art community. We'll all sign it for the
beginning. I want to make something very, very clear here. I mean, we're all people who have had a varying degree of love for Mozilla over the years, and we've put a lot of trust and respect into Mozilla. And I think all of us feel a bit extra cheesed off about this because it's so contrary to what we've come to expect and hope and dream for from the company that espouses the open web and technological and data freedom. And the fact that they are basically closing themselves off and treating the outside world this way is a huge, huge problem. And I would just like to say straight up to Mozilla, just fix it. We love you.
We need you.
I think we need you.
The open web is going to be a worse place without you, so figure it out.
We don't love you, exactly. And we want to again.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Honestly, I'm pretty pissed off at Mozilla right now. I think they're screwing up a ton, but I could be persuaded to change my mind on a dime if they just did a couple of little tweaks to how open and transparent they are as an organization and how willing they are to just talk to people. That would do everything.
Neil Stevenson isn't good at endings. Anyone who's read any of his stuff knows this. He's good at ideas. They're what his books are about. The Diamond Age wasn't about its plot. It was about nanotechnology. Anathem was about platonic epistemology. And Seven Eves, the new book, is about orbital mechanics. Basically, the moon blows up. No one seems to be very sure why it happens. But because this is sci-fi rather than a Michael Bay film, the moon isn't instantly vaporized into nothingness. All the rock is still there. So instead of a moon, you've got a cloud of boulders the size of the moon drifting around where the moon was. Then there's a popular scientist bloke on Earth who's called Dubois Harris, but clearly ought to be called Duneil deGrasse Tyson because that's who he is. He points out that all those rocks that make up the moon are going to come out of orbit and land on the Earth. Specifically, Earth is going to spend 5,000 years being bombarded by rocks from the sky, which will cause some problems. Specifically, it'll destroy everything. Everybody's dead, everybody is dead, everybody's dead, Dave. So the plan is set to stick a few thousand chosen people on the International Space Station so they survive and humanity continues to exist in the 2 years before rocks fall and everyone dies. That's the first third of the book. There are quite emotional scenes, actually, of people singing in St. Paul's Cathedral as the bombardment starts. Stevenson glosses over, but he makes you aware of the horrific Niagara of politics, which is going on back on Earth to decide who gets to live and who doesn't. But it's not the focus. The second third of the book is the story of these last few humans up in space. And this is where all the orbital mechanics stuff comes in. There's loving, pages-deep detail devoted to how the International Space Station rotates its angle of perigee and moves to a higher plane of rotation or something, right? I've got no idea whether all this stuff is actually true or not, but I assume it is. In American Psycho, the book by Bret Easton Ellis, Ellis went into huge, stupid detail about all the cravats and suits and pocket squares that the characters wear. But secretly, if anyone had actually worn the things that he described and worn them the way he described, they'd have looked stupid. Because Ellis knew everyone really would just gloss over the actual brand names and everything, just have a picture in the head of a bunch of jumped up 80s yuppie types. It's entirely possible that what Stevenson describes is actually the space station doing insane loop-the-loops as some kind of incredibly erudite joke on the reader, but destined only for astronauts among us. And this is not helped by how the International Space Station gets rechristened Izzy. Anyway, those of you who are imagining this becomes some sort of peace and flowers Star Trek world where everyone comes together in love will probably be better off reading something else. It's basically Lord of the Flies, but in space. Now, why didn't I see that coming? It's all quite believably told, mind you. I mean, a particular chapter in the middle where this venial ex-prison incites a schism, and I just couldn't bring myself to read it. But the rest of it, all very convincing. We end up with there being only 7 women left from the cast of thousands, and everyone else is dead. Dave. The third part of the book is 5,000 years later. Humanity's recovered, built cities in space, returning to the Earth, and is divided up into 7 separate tribes based on which of the 7 Eves, the 7 surviving women, they descended from. It's all very Brave New World in feel, assuming Huxley had stopped every 2 pages to lovingly describe how space elevators work. And then it ends. Anathem had a proper ending, so Stevenson's actually getting better at this stuff, but 7 Eves backslides a bit. It's all rather 60s sci-fi in approach. Back when the start of the story was some cool new idea you had about space, like solar sails or geosynchronous satellites or whatever, and the ridiculous lantern-jawed space hero was really only there to stand around and explain the cool physics. 7 Eves is like that. If you like that sort of thing, you'll like this. If you like Stevenson, you'll like this. If you like space engineering, you'll like this. The bad voltage verdict? If you like things like this, you'll like this thing. Especially if you already know what a perihelion is.
That's my favorite verdict. If you like things like this, you'll like this
thing.
I love it.
It's the truth.
Well said, sir. Well said.
This is the same bloke who wrote In the Beginning Was the Command Line, right?
Correct. A long, long, long time ago, but yes.
I liked that, and it was brilliant. And then, but he's really primarily a science fiction dude, right? I mean, people love his work. I've never read any of his books, but...
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
Is it better or worse? Is it just... If you had to sum up, like, whether you enjoyed it or not, binary decision, is this... Yes, like... Did you enjoy it in the same way that you've enjoyed previous books that you've done?
Yes, I would say it's an above-average Stevenson book. Some of his stuff is really... I really like Anathema. I like The Diamond Age. I like good. Snow Crash. Some of his stuff is unbelievably turgid, dull horror. Kryptonomicon was rubbish. The whole Baroque cycle
wasn't that
rubbish.
Bad. Kryptonomicon, I mean, come on. That's a good book. It's not my favorite book, but it's a good book.
Seriously, man, I got halfway into it. I wanted to drill a hole in my head and pour ants in just to get away from the misery. It's rubbish. But 7 Eves, I
not
would
fan,
say,
then.
It's not his best book because... It's basically not a book. He's had the idea, you know, the moon blows up, people have to leave Earth, they will live in space, Lord of the Flies, humanity evolved from that point on, which is an interesting kind of sequence of events. And then he's written a book which tells that sequence of events. It's not a story. It's like a guide or something.
It doesn't really
but
sound
it's
like
quite
it
engaging
has,
to read.
Does it not have like a character you can identify with through the majority of the book? It seems like it covers such a broad amount of time and whatnot.
Did you miss the bit where I said the gap in between the first 2/3 and the last
5,000
years? Right? No, yeah. There is not one character you can identify with throughout the whole book. But part of that, I mean, there are characters who are there, certainly for the first two thirds. And I think you're supposed to identify with some and you're supposed not to identify with some others. But the characters aren't the star of the show. You know, it's about the story. It's about the orbital mechanics and the coolness of the physics and the idea. And they just kind of stand around and point at it like a magician's assistant. They're not the point.
Let me ask you a question. So I don't read fiction. I read factual books. And
you sound like a grandma. I only like true stories.
Well, it's actually sadly quite true. And I have read a bit of fiction in the past. But one of the things that puts me off sci-fi is that I don't believe that my pathetic brain can actually visualize a lot of what's in there. Because sci-fi is complicated.
I think the same thing about your brain.
There are two different kinds of sci-fi, right? Hard sci-fi and soft sci-fi. Hard sci-fi is all very much, it's super accurate things. People like Greg Bale or whoever are writing stories where they're explaining all the physics all the way through it. And if you haven't got a degree, you'll find it difficult to keep up. But Doctor Who is sci-fi, right? You know, there's not a great deal of carefully worked out maths of orbital mechanics in that, but it's still science fiction.
Can I stop momentarily with a Greg Bear thing? I feel compelled to right now. So my wife, in many, many years past, used to work at a Half Price Books. You know, she worked at the bookstore. We're a book nerd family. And if you work at a Half Price Books, you can pretty much just have as many books as you want forever. And it's just, yeah, you like pay like a penny for all your books. So she worked
there.
For
Half Price.
Right. Well, for like nothing because they work there. And the employees walk around.
You're telling us that your wife worked at Half Price Bookshop and then basically stole a load of books.
We paid a penny for at least every book. This was up north of Seattle, Washington. Greg Bear lives in the area, right? He lives up north here. I kid you not, if you go into Half Price Books or even some of the Barnes and Nobles in the area, go to the section, look for Greg Bear books, open them up, and I dare you to find one that is not signed. He literally shows up at Half Price bookstores and out of the blue and will ask them if he can do a book signing event. And after a while, the kids, these like 18, 19, 20 year old kids working their retail job are like, ah, God damn it, Greg Bear. We don't have time to set up a table for you. Just go with a pen, sign whatever books you want. We don't even care if they're yours, and leave. And so literally I have probably a dozen signed Greg Bear books here that I consider my least valuable books that I own in my entire collection, despite the fact that they're signed, because it's so hard to find a non-signed Greg Bear book. This is just a really a tangential thing, but
the only other book I know like that is Art of Community. If you can find an unsigned copy Art of Community.
I was actually thinking the same thing.
No, you see, that's completely unfair. I have a signed copy of the Art of Community, but the three which are holding my door open are not signed. The worst thing about being Greg Bear is when you go back to a bookshop and say, can I sign some books? And then you find out that all the books that are yours and are there are already signed, which means no one's bought any since the last time you were in. Right.
That's what I always kept thinking, because every time I went in there, it looked like roughly the same stack of used Greg Bear books has not really changed, and they're all still signed.
The thing that Neil Gaiman does is, occasionally, if he's in an airport, he'll go into one of the airport bookstores, and if there's one of his books in there, he'll just sign it and put it back on the shelf. He won't talk to the people who run the shop or anything, just so someone will at some point buy the book and go, oh my God, it's a signed copy. How cool is that?
And the employees are just like, what's that crazy, creepy looking guy doing writing in all of our books before he leaves?
That guy is vandalizing some of our books. What is going on?
I mean, this story, folks, is Greg Bear. Thug life.
I would try this stuff myself, but there aren't that many airport bookstores with copies of DHTML Utopia in them, unfortunately.
That is crazy. That is a masterpiece.
All right. So it sounds like sci-fi fans would like this. It's a bit weird, not perfect, but overall.
Yeah, if you're the sort of person who likes Stevenson-style books, you'll like this, I suspect. If you liked Adatham, you'll like this. If you liked The Diamond Age, you'll like this.
Nice.
So stick with it.
Adatham
it's just more
was good.
Of the
it's
same,
a good book.
Really.
What if you like The Hungry Caterpillar?
I suspect this is then not your kind of book.
The Hungry Caterpillar was mostly about, like, space physics, right?
now on to the second installment in Bad Voltage Fixes the Fucking World, and this time up is SourceForge. And I think the GIMP for Windows project is the one that initially brought up this most recent issue with SourceForge. And for those of you who didn't get to kind of see what that was, they're wrapping a installer around some, they claimed it was five popular projects that they said were quote unquote abandoned. And what that installer did was optionally install some third party adware, and then after that, start the real installer. And as you can imagine, the community did not take that very well. And SourceForge has since indicated, based on that feedback, that they will stop doing this and they shouldn't have done it, and they're going to establish a community panel. Now, interestingly enough, they did this in 2013, and I will read you a quote from a press release shortly after they did this in 2013. Quote, "We want to reassure you that we will, all capital, never bundle offers with any project without the developer's consent." So 2 years later, they did exactly that.
Oh, so I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I mean,
to put this in context for those of you maybe not familiar with SourceForge a little bit, I think SourceForge was once, and admittedly many years ago now, a deeply trustworthy entity, right? They were very good stewards of open source.
They were.
I think VA, when they started it, really cared about the open source community. And I think they consistently not only took guidance from the overall community, but they would have never chosen profits over users or over projects or anything. So I understand markets change and leadership changes and acquisitions happen, and this, you know, they've been acquired multiple times and went in a bunch of different directions. But I think it's clear this means trusting a third party for something like this. Project hosting always has risks, especially when it's free, but I think it's easy to think of SourceForge for what they are now, and easy to forget what they were. So I just wanted to frame it in that way. And what do you guys think?
I mean, there were basically, you know, for people who aren't as familiar with the history, I think a nice way of describing it is they were essentially the GitHub of back in the day, but more, because
but
it was
so
like not
more.
Just a place that you could dump code. There was mailing lists, there was discussion, and they felt like they were on your side in building an open source project. Like, it was the place where open source got built.
They were like the combination of GitHub, Launchpad, and download.com all rolled into one Linux bundle.
Totally. And that was the beauty of it, especially when they first started out. The idea of building a project and then distributing files from it, you couldn't really do yourself because you didn't have web space. You had a little bit, maybe the ISP gave you or whatever, but you didn't have your own servers out there. There was no EC2 to spin up instances or S3 or anything like that. You didn't have servers plugged in a rack somewhere. So the idea of saying, well, I want to distribute this download, which is, you know, a megabyte or 5 megabytes, what happens if 1,000 people download it? It'll take my website offline. And SourceForge were there to help you do that and completely manage the project. Like you say, they had mailing lists, bug trackers, the works.
But
what's interesting here is this is a perfect example of slippery slope stuff, because they brought, as SourceForge's market share started to decline, they brought in the idea of this, we wrap your Windows installer in a larger installer as an opt-in thing, in order to say to people, look, we'll make some money at this, but you get to make some money too, developers. If you let us turn this thing on, we do it automatically. You just opt in and we will share some of the money with you. So it wasn't just, you know, them twirling their moustaches and tying a damsel to the railroad track. They did actually bring this in, whether you agree with the approach they were taking, they were doing it for semi-legitimate reasons, but the key point was it was opt-in.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question is, as we try to figure out how to fix SourceForge, is when did that slippery slope start? Because at least in my mind, SourceForge probably back in maybe like 2003, 2004 sort of time, just started being not as good of a place for hosting code. So there was like collab.net started forming, Launchpad became a thing. But then I think the thing that really turned people off SourceForge a little bit was Track, which was this, this essentially it's a set of Python scripts that you can use to run your own SourceForge, because web hosting was becoming more and more accessible.
Right.
So like, and I think the reason why people went to Track was because SourceForge was built using CVS, which had become essentially replaced by Subversion. And it took them ages to get Subversion support into SourceForge. So like people just, it started becoming a little less relevant. But there was never any question about, like, it just wasn't as good. There was never any question about whether they were doing the right or the wrong thing. It just was not as good of an option.
Right.
I don't know when it really started becoming this hive of, like, bullshit that it ultimately became.
Well, I don't see, think... I don't think it became a hive of bullshit until quite recently. What happened was, when they set up in 1999... there was nothing remotely like the idea of somewhere where you could put your project, they would handle all your downloads for you, they'd supply you a mailing list, they'd supply you space to run a website, the works.
It was absolutely pretty unique.
But then what they did was nothing for five or 6 years and coasted on their first mover advantage. Everyone was there, you went to SourceForge because it's all you knew about. When things like collab.net, Track, someone came about, they started to win because they were better, and they weren't better because the people doing it were massively more innovative. It's just that SourceForge hadn't done anything that was a good idea beyond set the thing up 5 or 6 years previously.
Right.
So you could switch to Track and say, wow, Track is much better for tracking my bugs because it integrates with Subversion stuff, and SourceForge haven't done that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But I you know, it's like... It feels to me, this whole recent thing, it feels to me like what's happened is the core that really understood developers and really understood like the spirit of open source, most of those people seem to have left because the technology became less interesting and less relevant.
I don't know anyone who works over there. Do you guys?
I don't know anyone anymore. But then you look and like Roberto Galapini is the one handling this current issue and he's pretty well known in the open source space.
Yeah, he's been around a while.
They do have more open source people still there than I initially had realized. I mean, as far as how they went downhill, to me, when you build a platform that you want developers to go to in the way of what SourceForge is in their context, I think there's really two key components, right? It's trust and it's tooling. Because if they don't trust you to treat their source code with respect and not modify it, and you're going to be there next week, trust in a lot of different ways, they're not going to adopt the platform. And if your tooling doesn't fit in with their workflow, you're not going to adopt the platform. And I think their tooling has been sliding for many, many years, obviously. I think now that the trust is also gone, a lot of places before stayed there out of inertia, I think. There's a surprising amount of still very popular projects on SourceForge. And I think another thing that a very large benefit of SourceForge is because they've been around so long, there's a fair amount of still useful but kind of abandoned projects that SourceForge still hosts and still keeps active.
There
a
are.
Surprising number. But now that that trust is gone, I think you're going to see the inertia change. I mean, to the point of them keeping stuff there, there's still a project I did from 2002 when I'd had like a LQ kernel patch set still on SourceForge. I have not seen that in a decade. But stuff you can still download there. Every version I ever released.
One of the big reasons that people are staying on SourceForge beyond just inertia, which is a lot of it. You know, if your project's abandoned, it will stay there because no one's touching it. If you don't want to move to somewhere else, then your project stays there because it's too much hassle to move. And if you're setting up a new project, you probably go somewhere else. But one of the reasons someone might choose to stay at SourceForge is, unlike almost anywhere else, they will host really big download files for you. You can distribute ISOs, full CD ISOs through SourceForge. Yeah, and almost no one else will do that, right?
Pigeon still uses SourceForge. Friggin' Pigeon.
You think, I'm going to go to Launchpad or whatever, right? Good luck uploading an 800 megabyte CD image to Launchpad.net, right? Epic fail is coming your way.
Right. There really is no replacement for SourceForge, even today. I mean, Savannah, kinda, Berlioz, kinda. There's a few almost replacements, but there's really no true new SourceForge that I know of.
So let's turn this, we all quite clearly agree that SourceForge has become a bit bollocks. And
It became a bit bollocks in 2008 when they realized they were bollocks. When everyone else in the world realized they were bollocks and stopped using them, they went, wow, this thing is costing us tons of money and we're not making dollar one. How can we make money? And that's the point at which you step over the bright line into shady practices.
Right. So they've gone from being bollocks and then trying to maybe reclaim some of the funding model
to being evil in order to make money
by just doing this thing. I don't know who is responsible for thinking this was an okay thing to do at SourceForge, But I'm amazed if that person is going to keep their job.
Like, I would guess it was someone at DICE, not someone at
Salesforce. At DICE. Like, whoever made this decision, I bet you anything what happened is somebody made this decision at DICE. I bet you the people who had been at SourceForge for a while really, really pushed back. And then, and I have no knowledge about any of this, whether this actually happened. I'm not pretending
that would make
I have
sense,
knowledge.
Though.
Yeah, but I bet you anything that the people at SourceForge really pushed back and said, this is going to destroy our reputation. The DICE people prevailed and did it anyway. And look what happened.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I guarantee you that's probably
here,
right? What happened.
I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit. I can see why, if you're sitting in a room somewhere and you say, we're going to do this thing where we wrap it, you know, we're not actually affecting their software. We're not changing their software. We're just basically hitching a ride along with it. And we're only going to do it for abandoned projects. Things where the people are cost, their project is costing us money to host it and have people go and look at it. But the project owners themselves don't give a shit. They're not participating in the SourceForge community. Hmm. They're not uploading new versions, anything like that. I still think I probably wouldn't agree with this whole wrap adware along with it, but I can see that there's a discussion to be had there, at least.
Well, they didn't originally just plan on doing it for abandoned projects, so they have that new thing called the SourceForge Open Source Mirror Directory, where if they feel a project is popular enough, they will mirror it on SourceForge, even if it had never been hosted on SourceForge before.
Oh, really?
And... yeah, that's new.
Yeah.
So I believe it was part of that. They were going to get some popular, like, I think OpenOffice was one of them. I believe even Firefox was one of them that they added to that directory. So they would become a mirror of that. And then they were going to, I believe the plan was eventually wrap it around those.
Yeah,
as
I mean,
well.
Really? The OpenOffice people, I'm not necessarily a fan of everything they do, but the idea of them... finding out one day that suddenly if you go and get LibreOffice and download it to your Windows machine that you also get the Ask toolbar, that's going to piss them off.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, that's why, like, I think we should be sensitive to the fact that this could really just be a really shitty business decision on somebody who is actually not particularly connected to SourceForge who was at DICE.
Right.
Because, you know, we got to be a little careful, you know, having come from Canonical, there was often cases where, you know, Canonical would make a decision that wasn't very widely well received in the community. I know we're struggling to think of what those decisions might be. But then people who worked at Canonical really felt beaten down, even though they had nothing to do with it.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's just life, right?
Right. But so to be clear,
how do we
right?
fix it?
So this segment is called Bad Voltage Fixes
so how do we
World,
fix
not
this?
Bad Voltage
yeah.
Pisses and
yeah,
Moans.
Exactly.
So the question really from my mind then becomes, can SourceForge, the platform, regain trust and redo the tooling in a way that makes modern open source developers want to use the platform again? And if not, why is there not a high quality gratis replacement for SourceForge?
So the two real questions are, how do they make it so that the developers want to go there to utilize it and make the users right. want to go there to actually download the stuff?
Yes.
How do they right. accomplish those two things?
There is a third thing, which is, while doing that, how do they get paid?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
to money be sustainable, they have to be self-sufficient.
That's a good point.
And that, I think, is their problem. It's not hard to think of ways to build a great hosting service for software and a thing which users can do. It is hard to think of a reason why you should funnel $10 million a year down the rat hole of doing it other than just to be nice.
I have a suggestion.
What do you got, John?
Maybe to kickstart this. I don't know. So this... I don't know where the funding will come from. That's a separate question. I think we could find it, right? I think we could find it. But looking at the options that are available today, assuming that a project does not want to host its own infrastructure,
yeah.
Most people are sticking stuff in GitHub.
Right.
That's become like the place where people put code. And GitHub is great for code hosting, and it's got issue tracking. And so it's got some elements of what makes SourceForge good. And I'd say that the way the GitHub people have built GitHub, they've done a really nice job there. However, GitHub, in my mind, is everything orientated around a code base. Whereas what makes an open source project interesting is it's not just the code base. It's about how people interact and discuss ideas and solve problems and things like that. When I think back to how we built projects in Ubuntu, there was like there was a lot of subtlety and nuance in how do you have meetings and how do you organize meetings and make sure you get work items at the end of them? And where do you track those work items and how do you keep on top of things and how do you plan releases and how often do you want to have releases? All the like the project management pieces, I'm fairly convinced that a lot of that stuff could be automated. This is not about like building Microsoft Project, which has got a million buttons to do a million different things, but like picking an opinionated way about how you take somebody who's a great developer who just wants to build something and help them through the process of actually building that thing. I'm not aware of any other site that really does that. And I think that complete with, you know, hosting code in Git or, you know, and the usual like staples, I think that would bring SourceForge into a new market that would be quite interesting.
So you essentially, the code here that runs the site is not the important thing. You glue together GitHub, Discourse, some kind of online tracking thing, something
and
which...
like another
you know,
file mirror thing, yeah.
Yeah, and then... the thing that SourceForge are providing is the fact that there aren't all these disparate services. They're providing the SourceForge project manager or whatever. Or
yeah,
product.
It's actually, SourceForge
actually you don't want
about-
a project manager, you want a product manager, really.
Right. Yeah. Right. So like I can imagine you go to SourceForge, you create a new project, and the first thing it says, you know, is you can select the cadence of how often you want to release it. So let's say you say we want to release every 6 months, which is pretty common in open source projects. You select that. And then what it will do is it will automatically recommend when you have meetings and when you set freezes and things like that, that you can obviously override any of it, but it does a lot of the thinking for you that is in people's brains in good open source projects. I think that would be really neat. I mean, it would cost a ton of money to implement,
yeah.
But I think that would be unique that they don't care.
Well, here's the thing. To make money off of it, I mean, they clearly love banner ads. I'm here on the SourceForge page for Pigeon, and there is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 web banner ads on just this one page alone. So assume that on average, they're getting roughly 10 banner ad impressions per page load. You go through a couple of like project management things. You have to go to the root project page. You go to the files page. They're going to get 80 to 90 banner impressions, advertising impressions off of a person just coming to download a file. So I think if they can't make that profitable, they're probably doing something else really weird.
Well, yeah, but bear in mind that half the reason we don't like SourceForge is precisely because the download button is one pixel, right? And everything
and I think
else
a lot of projects
is banners.
A lot of projects just use them as a file repository where they just link to the downloadable file from their own website and get completely around any ads and just
use them as a
have to undo that,
I am worried that Jono's marvelous plan is basically describing Launchpad on that. That's
it
what Launchpad was
No. John's describing something I think far more grand.
More than Launchpad.
Yeah.
Much like, more Launchpad than Launchpad. Launchpad is GitHub designed around the norms of Ubuntu.
It totally isn't. No. The thing which makes Launchpad and not GitHub is that GitHub is about source code. Launchpad is about
making things hard to find.
Management.
Right.
It's about organizing your team. That's why things like Launchpad Answers exist. It's why Blueprints exist. It's why you have to register a project and then register sub-projects and do that. GitHub went, you know what we're going to do? The source code is the important thing. You want to organize a team around this is your problem, not ours.
No, but the thing is, Launchpad provides the tools to set up well-organized projects. I agree. But the logic around how you use those tools... informed guidance or heuristics around how that works, right? And that's what I think is missing. Like I've met so many people in the open source world who are brilliant developers who have a really good idea, but they just don't know how to organize a project and get people involved and keep it rolling because they're great programmers. They're not project managers. They're not community managers. And I think a site that provides an automation around that. And it would be very, I think it should be, the key thing is it would be opinionated. It would be the SourceForge model of how that works, not like, you know, you can choose five different ways in which you can run a project.
I
it would
certainly
be one
think
way.
I mean, to be honest with you, the way they are currently perceived by the community, even before this latest image made everyone hate them, they were perceived with, at best, indifference, and at worst, being forgotten about. So any move in any direction is an improvement at this point, right? I am personally of the opinion, though, that what you do is you get a great big steamroller and you drive it over Source Forge, and then you set up Jono's new thing and you call it Boss Forge or something, right? Because I think the name is now dead. No one's ever going to trust them again. They got Nmap and wrapped it with other stuff, for God's sake.
Yeah, I wonder if the person who made this decision of the wrapping thing really understands how absurd Nmap being wrapped with this is. Like, I'm pretty sure.
They did claim that Nmap was never affected. I don't know whether that. I cannot attest to the veracity of said statement, but they did rebut right. that. Specific.
Oh, I confess, oh, really? I haven't checked.
They said part of their policy was to never wrap anything to do with the network security industry because they clearly would not want such things.
Oh, whereas people who make,
as if everyone else does want them.
Yeah, everyone else is fine.
That's an assumption.
I mean, I kind of get that. You got to draw the line somewhere. Yeah. At least they drew a line, which is more than some companies do.
So it seems like, wrapping it up here, it seems like the most of the panel thinks that the Source Forge we all know and loved has been dead for years, and it's just taken us a while to notice the smell in this most recent incident wafted it up.
This is a depressing show, isn't it?
I think this is interesting.
You either die a hero or live long enough to become a villain, I guess.
I think realistically, we're just talking about what the rest of the community thinks as well. I think this is a pretty common set of thoughts. Right. What I'm going to find interesting is, after this show comes out, let's reach out to the SourceForge guys and see if they want to come talk about their vision for SourceForge, what they want to do for it. And maybe they'll have some cool ideas. Maybe they'll have some reasons why it is the way it is currently, and maybe they'll make sense. Let's reach out to them and see what they think.
And
maybe, unlike Mozilla, maybe they'll respond.
I think Roberto would probably come on the show. Hopefully.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, and if they don't come on the show, we'll just bollock them in the next show like we did with Mozilla.
Exactly. So SourceForge, you can't save the projects, you can't save the source code that runs the projects, and you can't save the brand. What's your next step? Comment to show@badvoltage.org.
Let's take a break from telling other companies how terrible they are for a minute. We did this thing over the last couple of weeks where we all decided, hey, let's promote the show a little bit. And this is a crazy idea, I know, but let's tell other people that we have this show called Bad Voltage. And we thought, so we had this discussion. We had this chat. We're like, well, how do we do it beyond just, you know, Jono tweeted out and I'll put it up on Google Plus. Like, what do we do to promote the show? So we thought, let's all spend just like $50 each and do advertisements on a bunch of different like social media platforms and see what actually was useful. So we thought we'd share all this information with you guys in part so that you guys can see, well, how badly we did at advertising our own show. So I did Twitter. So I spent $50 on doing promoted ads on Twitter. Stuart, you did Reddit, right?
Yep, I did Reddit.
All right, and Jeremy, which ones did you do?
The one I actually picked was Facebook because I thought it would be the most futile, but LinkedIn during this just happened to send me a $50 credit, so I also used that.
Nice. And Jono, which one was the one that you did?
My targeted goal here was a variety of adult websites.
Okay, a variety of adult websites. Well,
not just one.
Let's put you off to the side for a minute, Jono, while you kind of collect your porn-related advertising thoughts. Yes. Stuart, I'm kind of curious about this. I've never tried advertising on Reddit. How did it go?
Well, I've never tried advertising at all, anywhere, for anything, right? So this was kind of a learning experience for me. But advertising on Reddit is very, 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 very easy. You go there and then you pay them a bit of money and you say, this is the text of my ad. And then it appears, people who've used Reddit will have seen ads appear at the top. It appears like a post on Reddit, right?
Right.
And then you say, here's my $50. And you could either say, show it to everybody, or you can say, show it to a certain subset. So I picked these subs.
Can you add it? Can you target just one subreddit?
I don't think you can target one individual subreddit.
You used to be able to.
You may be able to.
I think there are, your story, Stuart.
Well, there are certain because we only went in with a very small budget, right? there are limits to what you can do at that small budget. You can do more if you have a more wide-ranging ad campaign. So my choice, if I remember rightly, was between advertising everywhere and advertising to what they call a collection. And I picked technology buffs. So that's a group of subreddits that they've selected. And, you know, in the technology buffs one, there's /r/Linux and /r/technology and /r/Android and stuff like this, you know. And it seemed like the right sort of place to aim Bad Voltage. I'd like us to reach out into the mainstream world and become Serial or This American Life, but we probably ought to get all the techies first. So,
good thinking.
$50 buys you 50,000 impressions. So that's 50,000 individual page views of one of those Reddits, and Reddit itself chooses from among the ads that are available to it and shows one at random every time someone opens the page, right? So we got, actually, we paid 50,000 impressions and they give you about 50,000. So we got 51,221.
Ooh, which was nice. We got a bonus.
So we got 1,221 free impressions. And the important point here, the magic thing, is the CTR, the click-through rate. And what that is the number of people who, having seen your ad, clicked on it. You then need to get... What would happen if they clicked on it is it took them to the Bad Voltage website. So we would then want to think about, if they came to the Bad Voltage website, did they actually become listeners to the show? Did they hear a show? Did they join the community? Whatever.
But we're not that clever, right?
But we're not that clever yet. The point was just to see how many clicks we got. If of those 50,000 clicks, 49,993 of them clicked on the ad and ended up on the website, then we deal.
Fantastic, yeah.
With the thing.
Yeah.
I can tell you, 49,993 people did not click on the ad. The CTR, this click-through rate, you would expect it to be, doing some research into general online advertising, about 0.1%, which means about 1 in 1,000 people will click on your ad. And we got 0.14%. So we were pretty much dead on the average. We did exactly what you'd expect from internet advertising. You put something out there, you get you buy 50,000 impressions, and 76 people clicked on it.
And that was a text ad, right? That wasn't an image or anything like that.
So roughly with Reddit, that was $50, right? You get 1 in 1,000 click through. So you're paying roughly $1 per person who ends up at your site.
Right.
Or who follows the ad.
But then we don't know the conversion rate in terms of listener.
No, absolutely not.
So those people may show up and think, all right.
Well, that's pointless.
Well, to be fair, we could have tracked that, we just didn't in this iteration of the...
We could have done, but that required extra effort, and I was already spending money and putting effort in, so I thought, fuck that. If they turned out to be a brilliant idea, then we'll do more of it. But I'm not building an ad tracking network only to find that only 76 people clicked on the thing.
All right. So you're 0.14.
Yep. My click-through rate, 0.14. That's pretty friggin' delightful. And the ads are $50, gets you 50,000 impressions. So you're paying about 80 cents per person who clicks.
Right. And at least you get exposure to the brand.
That would be the CPC figure here, which is 66 cents.
Right.
Roughly.
66 cents.
The benefit of the impressions, of course, is that people get to see Bad Voltage as a thing.
Yeah.
So... So there's a twofold benefit. All right, who's next? Jeremy, how do you get on?
So, I started with Facebook, and I just made a promoted post, is what they call it. So I did Bad Voltage is a podcast featuring myself, along with John O'Bacon, Stuart Langridge, and Brian Lunduke. Delivers an amusing take on technology, open source, politics, music, and anything we think is interesting, as well as interviews and reviews. Good listening, Bad Voltage, and the link. So you have to pick an age there. I just did above 18. I did both male and female, and for interests, I picked iPhone, Android, open source software, Linux, and technology, which is a pretty broad, and I targeted it at...
That sounds like a description of the show.
Yeah. So for our $50 on Facebook, there was 44,782 impressions. 124 people actually clicked on the ad, which is a cost per engagement of 79 cents. Of those, 42 people clicked through again to the site. So
how does that compare to ACK?
More people engaged with the ad, but less people, because of the way they do the ads, actually clicked through to the site. And then with the...
Right. We're on the same sort of order. I mean, yes, yeah. The Reddit one did not slightly miles better. Off, yeah. But yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, we got about the same number of impressions. Of those impressions, about the same number of people engaged. So you're spending about the same amount of money. It's still... I mean, you were what? Well, your CPC, your cost per engagement was 70?
79 cents, but that's cost per engagement, which is a little bit different.
Right.
My cost per click to the site would be almost exactly the same as yours.
Yeah, so about 66 cents. So we're still talking on the order of 60, 70, 80 cents to get someone to click.
Same kind of ballpark.
And appear on your website.
Yeah.
All right.
Interesting.
Right.
Mr. Lunduk.
So I went with Twitter, and I focused... You can do Twitter advertisements in a few different ways. You can advertise your accounts. You can advertise, you know, a particular tweet and whatnot. But what I decided to do, because I wasn't really sure how effective any of mine would be, I decided to use just promoted tweets, which basically takes tweets I already had and promoted them and basically put them at the top of people's feeds who really didn't want them there in the first place, which is really nice of me to have done that. And I started doing it, and it was just not working terribly well. I promoted a I can't remember what it was. It was one of our goofy tweets from a little while back, but that linked on to a particular episode of the show, and I just promoted that one, and I spent about $22 on it and got, you know, a handful of retweets and favorites and whatnot, and that's really about it. And I thought, well, this is a bit crap considering I just spent 20 some bucks. I mean, not like it's a lot of money, but I it's not like it didn't get significantly more like retweets or favorites than if I just posted some random crap and not paid anything. So right, I'm like, okay, right. So I'm going to try a different one now. I'm going to try a different one that I'd sent out a little more recently. It was a little bit more generic about just, hey, show badvoltage.org and promote that one. And that one did equally not that great. And I think now part of this might be how I targeted people. I might have been a little bit too specific. I focused really on the open sourcey side of things.
Question, was this promoting Brian Lunduk tweets? No,
these were my tweets, because I you can only promote tweets in your own account. I can't promote the tweets at Bad Voltage. I can't
corruption
promote those.
Oh,
Bad
no,
Voltage
these
were tweets about Bad Voltage and linking to Bad Voltage, so it friggin' counts. Oh, by the way, Jono, when you were going around to all these porn sites, were you using the official Bad Voltage account when you were advertising, or was it using the Jono Bacon account?
Please tell me we don't have an official Bad Voltage account.
Let's stop talking about Brian on Twitter. I want to focus on Jono here, because I think this is more interesting. So my results, honestly, were probably significantly worse, I feel, than either Reddit or Facebook. It wasn't bad, but I don't really feel like it was worth my money to throw into it. You know what I mean? Like for a test, it was fine, but I don't know that I do like a $1,000 ad campaign on Twitter, because it, I don't know. Maybe it's just that we have a lot of followers anyway, and so we're going to get decent coverage anyway.
Right.
So we don't really need that. So maybe that's all that is for that.
Well, I can certainly, speaking anecdotally here, occasionally, you know, a thing will come up on Reddit and I'll think, oh, that looks interesting or whatever. Don't use Facebook, but whatever. But I've never once clicked on an ad on Twitter, and every time I've seen one, it's made me annoyed.
Neither
have I. Actually, that brings up something I wanted to ask you about, Stuart. So on Reddit, you can have ads that are essentially promoted Reddit posts, right? But
yeah.
But yet at the same time, if you go to Reddit and you post a content, like a link to your own show, most of the people on Reddit will anally rape you. So are advertisements where you're essentially doing the exact same
not,
thing?
That's not what
for
they'll
even
do. They will be cross with you. Yes.
No, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure.
No,
no,
they won't. Right?
Those are two very different
markets. That's my impression.
But like, yes, if you shill your own thing as an account, then yes, everyone gets apocalyptic.
But if you pay for the privilege,
if
then they're happy with it.
If you pay for the privilege, but then it shows it shows up at the top of the screen. It's very clearly an ad, in the same way that ads come up at the top of Google search results. It's not like it just looks like an ordinary post, and no one knows it's an ad.
Got it. Okay, fair.
Yeah,
fair. All right, now Jono, tell me about your experiences in the adult entertainment industry.
So the idea here was to basically, I've heard that, you know, the best performance, shall we say, of advertising is on porn websites, because it's cheaper. Most people don't want to actually push their products on there, and people generally actually click on the stuff, which is weird because, you know, it's one-handed web surfing. So I basically investigated...
Bear in mind that it's not just that it's cheaper, right? People are occasionally worried about, you know, contaminating their brand, a thing about which we seem to not care.
No. I would say that the premise of contaminating a brand, it steps way beyond this.
It is possible that porn sites are now worried about contaminating their brand by having bad voltage.
It is possible.
It is not sexy.
So how does this work?
So basically, Jeremy, actually, when we were talking about this, mentioned something which I should have thought about, which I didn't, which was Jeremy made some joke in the planning that somebody, you know, one of these porn sites, some Bulgarian porn site, is going to steal your identity. So as soon as he mentioned that, I thought, I really don't want that to happen because I need to give these people my credit card number. Okay. So I did some digging around, and there is honestly not that many options from what I could tell in terms of how you advertise on porn sites. I thought you'd pick a specific site. So, you know, I asked some friends which porn sites they go to, because I don't know anything about this world, obviously.
Also, so least comfortable conversation with your friends ever.
I mean, all I need is a Sears catalog. Anyway, so I basically did some research, and then there's this site called trafficjunkie.com. And basically the way this works is that they have done deals with all of these different porn sites where they essentially take the advertising and then they feed it out to all of these different sites. So, and there's loads on there. There's, you know, there's
is there loads?
Hub and
but they're basically they're the only ad broker in town when it comes to adult sites.
Pretty much from what I could see. So anyway, thanks, Brian.
You're welcome.
So I went to use Traffic Junkie. So the first thing, you know, this is visual advertising. There's no text ads here. So the first thing I did was make some ads, right? So I will share these on the forum. But one of them, I wanted to make this personal to the show. So I basically have a blurry image of each of us, or each of you. Very blurry, so you can't make out who that person is. So the first one is a very, very blurry image of Brian in our like group fighting shot from Scale. And then it says in text, "Nothing turns me on like an annoying hipster in a brown jacket." And then the Bad Voltage logo. I thought somebody would find that curious, and they click on it. I took a zoomed-in image of Stuart, again, blurred out with a hat on, and I put, "Nothing turns me on like a ginger fella who showers with a Bluetooth speaker." And then for Jeremy...
Not that I'm disagreeing with you, you understand, but hi.
Blurred this out, and I wrote, "I am hot for a short dude who boils food in a bag to feel good about his height." I thought they'd be interesting. And then, you know,
Did you make one for yourself?
Of course I didn't, no. And then I wanted one for all of us, and it basically, and I thought this one was definitely going to be the one that would perform well. And it says, "Short, period, redheaded, period, English, period, glasses, period, here, period." So, you know, it's one element of all of us.
That is like a specific niche, redheaded, English, glasses, right there.
Yeah, right there. So I uploaded them. I went and created a campaign on the website, uploaded them. And then it turns out you have to call them and get your campaign approved, right? Because they don't want people uploading like goat porn or whatever else to their...
Oh, because that would be a terrible thing to show on a porn website.
You know, it turns out that, you know, Stuart, yes, it would.
That would be terrible.
A little bit of me wanted to test them. I have to see what could get rejected. Because if they can accept ads for click here to cheat on your wife type ads, then our stuff should be okay, right? So anyway, I called them up. They approved the ads. They said everything looked okay. And then they wanted, I needed to make the payment. You can either pay with PayPal or with a credit card. So PayPal was like 2 or 3 day wait. So I said, okay, I'll do credit card. This is when the guy said to me, okay, credit card's fine. He said, all you need to do, well, he said, the way most people do this is that they put their ID above the credit card. So when you take the picture of it and send it to us, you can have both in the same image.
What?
And I was like, What? And I said to him, you're telling me that I have to provide my drive, a picture of my driving license and my credit card to use the service? And he said, yeah. And I said, no other website that I've ever been to buy anything, you've ever had to do that. And he says, well, we have a lot of fraud. I said to him at that point.
He said, well, okay, that's just all part of the service here at identitytheft.com. Right?
So did you just switch to PayPal or?
So I said to him, okay, how do I do it with PayPal? And he said, oh, with PayPal, you have
to
provide...
How about I send you cash in the post? That's what's right. happening now.
With PayPal, he said, you have to provide two forms of ID.
What?
But it's... continue.
So I said, no thanks. And I put the phone down on him. So I didn't end up actually advertising.
Oh no.
Because it's actually Jeremy's fault because he made me think about the identity theft thing. I don't want my identity
John,
stolen.
No, I would have, before Jeremy said that, sent a picture of my ID along with a credit card bacon.
Probably not, honestly. So, I would like to open this up to the Bad Voltage audience. I am willing to pay anyone in our community $50 if you can have the largest impact on advertising the show. Oh. We need to figure out exactly how this is going to work, right? This is the first time the guys are hearing about it by people. We've not talked about
this. I have to
say,
I'm secretly glad that your idiotic plan to advertise on porn sites didn't work, by the way.
Yeah. It is actually... I'll make these pictures available as well.
So, I thought it would be terribly amusing to do so. I just didn't realize that you had to literally give your identity to some guy.
That is the weirdest thing
in order
I've heard
to do
in a long time.
So Traffic Junkie, no thank you.
I am disappointed that you failed to advertise, but... Equally, would have done precisely the same thing.
What is your challenge to the community here?
Jono, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you. It's okay. I tried. You did the right thing.
I did try. So I've got $50 burning a hole in my pocket, right? And I'm happy to PayPal somebody $50, right? If they can demonstrate that
along
they've advertised
the
show significantly.
License.
Yeah. I'll send you. Yeah. No. So let's keep this simple. Anyone out there, right? Go and advertise the show. Tell people to come and check it out, right? And whatever the largest amount of effort you put into advertising the show, getting it out there, encouraging people to click on it, because it's going to be difficult to actually track the actual traffic.
Yeah, like
I will independently award somebody $50. I will PayPal you $50. And of course, you will have kudos in the show as well.
I got 51,221 people to hear about the show. Can I have $50?
All right, so everybody, you have to beat Stuart.
In more ways than one.
Thank God this show is done. It is totally done, which means no more us being pissed off at other companies for how much they suck. And that's pretty friggin' fantastic. Guys, is there anything going on in the universe we need to tell people about?
Do you know what? There is.
no shit. I was just saying that hoping and for the best, but if we've got actual stuff, rock it out.
Why don't we talk about Bad Voltage Live? Now, we did this in Los Angeles back in February.
And it was awesome.
And it was a bit of an experiment. We did it at the one always wonderful Scale conference. And I think we'd all agree it went pretty well. People seemed to have a good time at the show. We had a great time. You can go and check out the video for yourself. It's on the website.
Wait a minute. What's this pretty well bullshit? We rocked that room. That was man. People
it was
drunk.
Fun.
People took their clothes off. We talked about Linux. Fun was had.
Yeah, you're right. It was fucking brilliant. And we were brilliant. And, you know, people should respect that. Anyway.
people should respect that because we said so.
There's a guy called Taurus Balog, who, apart from being a cool guy, also has a name from a Hobbit movie. And he basically came out. I've known him for years. Jeremy's known him for years. We're like, oh, we should get you guys out to do a European Bad Voltage show. So we are pleased to announce that on the 30th of September, 2015, not 3015, we will be doing the Bad Voltage Live European Vacation. It's going to be the University of Applied Sciences in some place called Fulda that none of us had ever heard of in Germany. It's going to be a full show. The only thing that's going to be a little different is that Brian, unfortunately, can't go because he has the audacity to have a child.
Yeah, I'm a real jerk because of that. Literally, so my I've got a daughter. I've got a my second kid who's going to be a boy, which means I get to have one of each, which is rad, is due like days before this event. So if I went, I'm pretty sure I would be the worst parent ever. So I think I'll step aside on this one.
Yeah, we did actually suggest that maybe the Bad Voltage European audience was more important than the new child, but Brian, to his credit, did not go for this particular argument. Plus, we have a tradition of only doing this with three people, right? So we get insects, only three of us eat them. We do a European tour, only three of us show up. But Brian is going to be on the show. Yes, he is. We are going to find some way he's going to be there, even if not in person. We're going to have a robot or something. Jerry is holding up to the camera one of those scorpions in a lollipop things. They are wrong. Stop doing it. There will be none of those in Germany. But yes, you should come to Germany, to Fulda in Germany, on the 30th of September 2015. And to find out more about it, go and register. Go and look at badvoltage.org/live. Go there.
Everything's on there. It's going to be €5 to get in, but that's primarily so we can gauge attendance. And this is something that... So this is... Bad Voltage Live is going to be part of the Open NMS Users Conference. And but the show is open to anyone, okay? You don't have to be going to that conference. And of course, it's Europe. It's cheap to get flights. It's cheap to travel. So come out and check out the show. Brian will be in the show. He just won't be physically in the show. But we're coming up with all kinds of cool ideas about how we can make sure that Brian is as part of a show as anything else.
I'll find a way to shoehorn myself into this. That's what I do.
Even if it's like a Google Hangout as your wife is pushing you to get out.
Oh, my God.
Come to Germany and... See the live show, hang out with us. You know, it'll be a laugh. Yep. Germany's pretty good.
Germany's pretty good. That should be their new like whole country motto. That should be their marketing campaign.
Germany
Deutschland is it's sehr gut.
Yeah, so you're €5, there's beer, and we're gonna have a blast. So yeah, come and hang out with us. Should we talk about the questions thing?
Yeah,
I think we should.
So we have this idea, unless someone else wants to talk about this, because I don't want to dominate, but given the fact that we talked about this minutes before we pressed the record
button. Dominate away.
All right, so we're going to do a new thing where basically if you have any questions, any burning questions, or you want to ask us about something, you can send it to show@badvoltage.org, and we're going to take a look at the best questions that will be a combination of interesting and funny and whatever else, and we will strive to answer at least one question on every show. Now, you can ask questions about anything. It doesn't have to be about nerdy stuff. If you want to ask questions about politics, about music, if you just got to ask anything you like.
Anything at all.
Send it to show.
I was going to say, to be clear, it could be something that was in the show or something completely unrelated to any show.
Yeah, anything.
Just a question.
Anything you like. Send it to show@badvoltage.org. Get your questions in. We'll obviously credit you unless you, you know, say if you don't want us to mention your name, that's fine as well. But get your questions in and then we will answer them from the next show onwards. If there's no questions, there'll be no answers.
And in case you couldn't understand it because of Jono's crazy accent, that is show@badvoltage.org. I would like to make one additional point with this. If we elect to not use your question, that is absolutely a referendum on your quality as a human being. But go ahead and send those questions on in, and we'll do our best to possibly answer them.
Once again, Brian Lundu does not necessarily represent the views of Bad Voltage.
That actually, might have to be the new tagline for the show.
If we choose not to use your question, it is actually a referendum on Brian's personality and value as a human being.
All right. So, excellent. Good show. It's been fun as usual.
Sorry, Brian. This show was slightly delayed. It is Jono's fault.
It is my fault. It is my fault. I was in a work thing. Although, unlike some, I show up for most of the shows.
Hey.
So
that's I show up for most. So that's something.
That is something.
But Brian is here. Much as we did pretend a couple of shows ago that he was gone away.
he is actually here,
back with us. The four of us are back coming at you. So we'll see you in Germany.
Oh, man. So,
and you'll hear from us in 2 weeks.
2 episodes ago, apparently they were pretending like I just
just disappeared. Like, maybe they just disappeared me off the show. I get an email from Jono, and he's like, hey, we had this great idea. We're going to pretend like we kicked you off the show, and we're just not going to tell everyone, and we're going to see if the internet just, like, freaks the hell out. When he sent me that email, I can't remember if I was just about to board a plane or something, and so I get the email, and I'm like, okay, that's kind of funny, and I'm like, oh, crap, I got to go. So I put my phone down, and I hop on my tablet down, and I hop on the plane or whatever, and then I totally forgot to reply. And so then, like, a couple of days later, I hadn't replied or anything, and I get this message from Stuart, and he's like, man, are you okay, man? Like, he was, like, checking in on me. He's, like, making sure I didn't have hurt feelings or nothing. It was fantastic.
Well, you are a very sensitive wallflower. You are the wallflower of the team. This is clear.
I'm very delicate.
You are delicate. Delicate London.
Hey, Jono, could you hit the stop button? This show is getting long.
Let's do that. Let's do it.